Hi there, listener. It's Matthew. You've come looking for an episode of the Children's Book Podcast, and you've found it. Hooray! But you're probably wondering why the name of the podcast has changed. After 8 years of doing the Children's Book Podcast, I began a new career as head of podcasts at A Kids Company About, where I now oversee a podcast network dedicated to producing original content that talks up to kids, centers the things going on in their world, and engages and challenges how they see the world and themselves. All of the episodes of the Children's Book Podcast are still here, but now, if you're subscribed, you'll get new episodes of Worth Noting, a kids podcast about current events, hosted by me. Something for you and the young people in your life to enjoy together. Enjoy this episode, and I hope you'll check out Worth Noting and other podcasts from A Kids Company About. Meet Neil Porter, influential publisher behind such books as A Sick Day for Amos McGee, The Iridescence of Birds, and School's First Day of School. Welcome to All the Wonders, the Children's Book Podcast. I'm Matthew Winner. This is episode number 294 of the podcast with Neil Porter, renowned publisher and beloved children's book advocate. Neil has a track record for publishing books that become timeless favorites, such as Philip and Aaron Stead's A Sick Day for Amos McGee and Laura Vaccaro Seeger's Dog and Bear. The books he publishes all share this tangible voice that feels unquestionably like they're part of the same family, the same message, the same place of love. It should be no wonder that the man behind these books, supporting these artists, has one of the kindest, most sincere hearts around. It's time for you to meet Neil. Here's episode number 294 of the podcast with Neil Porter. Welcome to the podcast, Neil Porter, at long last. I'm so excited to get to talk to you.
Well, thank you very much, Matthew, for having me. This is great. I've been a fan for a long time of your podcast.
Oh, goodness. That's very kind. I had no idea about that. I was saying just before recording that I can point to two sort of beacons in the past guests that I've talked to that have pointed me directly toward you. And so I knew it was time to give you a call. And that is Phil Stead, and then with Lisa Brown with the Airport book. And it was specifically the way that those two each talked about you and your hand in making their books as special as they are. And those happen to be two very special books for me this year. So I was excited to have the opportunity to get to sit down with you.
That's great, and vice versa. So here we go.
Here we go. Okay, so Neil, you have been in the business for 30-some years doing...
Yeah, emphasis on the some.
Some. With, with emphasis on your influence on children's literature over that time. I know that I read in a Hornbook interview with you from years ago. I remember finding out about your name there, because I come from the library world. I'm only sort of recently more deeply aware of what goes on in children's literature. But to know that I started to see your names on books, and they were on books that I really, really liked. And then I started to hear stories of what a great guy you were. Over this time, I just know that you not only have had a profound influence on children's literature, but also on the people making it. So thank you for that.
That's very kind of you, Matthew.
You also said, though, a thing that I'm like, there's no way I can avoid talking about this, that initially you grew up not reading children's books, that it sort of was something you came to later in life.
Well, yeah. I mean, I was a precocious kid, I guess. I learned to read when I was very, very young, before I even got to school. I don't know how or why, but there you are. Apparently, I was reading, labels off of cans while I was sitting in a supermarket. Basket being wheeled around. And anyway, that's the story that I've been told. Of course, I don't remember any of that. But I do remember that when I got to kindergarten, being able to read was sort of a double-edged sword because, it's not great for your cred to be called in front of the room and asked to read something. And that used to happen fairly often. So I kept a very low profile. But it's really picture books that I don't remember having a strong connection with. A couple maybe seep into my consciousness, but I guess I was reading early, I was sort of moving along and reading older books. So yeah, it's only later that I came to love them, as I do now.
I love that you came to love them. What brought you into publishing? Did you grow up being interested in writing, or was it more that you had continued the interest in the written word itself?
Well, it's interesting. I came out of theater, sort of. I grew up in Philadelphia, and a lot of shows tried out in Philadelphia before they came to Broadway. And my parents introduced me to theater at an early age, and I spent my my middle school and high school years actually taking the train down to Center City, Philadelphia, and seeing a lot of really bad musicals on their way to Broadway. Legendarily bad musicals and plays. But I loved the theater, and I really thought, wouldn't it be cool to get paid for going to the theater? So I wanted to be a critic, of all things, and went to NYU to study dramatic literature and theater history. I think that was the major. It was a very odd major. And of course, I got dumped out with very little money in my pocket and a lot of student loans to pay. And I wanted to stay in New York, and I suspected that the New York Times was not going to offer me their first string drama critic position. So I needed a job, and a friend of a friend needed an assistant, and so I became an assistant in the college department of St. Martin's Press. That was my first job in publishing. So I often think that if that friend of a friend ran a plumbing supply company, I hope I would have had a very creative career in plumbing supplies.
Oh, but I love that. I love even the notion of a creative career in plumbing.
I don't know. But anyway, it was a series of happy accidents, really, because from textbook publishing, which I really wasn't tremendously interesting, I didn't find it creative or stimulating. It's a very lucrative side of the publishing business because you're publishing to fit a gap in the market, an introduction to psych book or something like that. But yeah. It wasn't the book. It wasn't the kind of books that I wanted to read nor edit. So I moved from textbooks into trade books and had a series of marketing positions within publishing companies. And that led into my interest in children's books. And that ultimately led into an opportunity to actually edit them. Does that make sense? That.
It does. And I love that your background in wanting to see theater, but then the interest in being able to critique it, being able to articulate from that very nature, to articulate the things that speak to you. I feel like all of that quality still remains there in the work that you're doing. And that voice then informs what we see, what we read. So many people, when I told you, I reached out to my friends on social media and said, I'm talking to Neil Porter. What do you want to ask me? And so many of them, as I am as well, were interested in what brought you in. But it's so great to hear that, knowing the books that you have. I mean, Neil, for what I know of your books, they often tend to be thoughtful, beautiful books. I'm hesitant to say quiet because they're not always quiet in what they're saying, but there is a feel to them that feels, I don't know, like I think about ideas are all around, and I feel like the way that Phil handled that was in such a way that we can approach it and not be afraid. And not all books tell that story.
Well, it's interesting that you bring up Phil's book because it's a book that I cherish. And, you know, it's interesting. When he first submitted that book, the text for that book, he submitted two picture book ideas, that and a book that subsequently became Samson and the Snow, which we're publishing this fall. Yes. And Samson and the Snow is a beautiful story, and it's really conventional. Well, I hate to say conventional in terms of Phil, because he's not a conventional kind of guy. But it follows all of the accepted framework of a picture book. And ideas are all around with something else. It was much longer. It didn't have a traditional plot. It meandered around as the protagonist in the story. Phil himself meanders around the neighborhood trying to come up with an idea to write about, and that was the nucleus of the book. And I've always been attracted to books about process, how you get from point A to point B, how a painting gets made, which was the subject of Action Jackson, a book I did some years ago with Jan Greenberg and Sandra Jordan and Robert Andrew Parker, which wasn't a biography of Jackson Pollock, but it was an account of how he painted one particular painting in the spring of, I think, 1950. And that's the kind of book that really intrigues me, that, you know, just excites me. I'm a process kind of guy.
I like that. And you talk about Phil. That book, I've talked about that book ever since I've had my hands on it, which has been a while. But that book has become, to me, if NPR, if This American Life was translated into a picture book, I feel like its ideas are all around. It's a walk. How better to have a walk with the author to experience that process and know, I've been on this walk before. This is something I've gone through. So I think I can completely understand why you'd be attracted to those books, and also books that do it in that way, in that authentic and sincere way, the same way that Action Jackson does, but to do it in that way that not just a step-by-step, some sort of contrived book, but something that really has a heart that speaks.
Yeah, and I think there's tremendous heart in the book, and it's interesting. There have been comments about the book. Is it really a book for children? Trying to think of some of the things that people have said about it. Is it child-friendly, which is the obvious kind of fallback position?
You know this because it's been 30 years that you've been working, but you know that those questions come from, like, insecurity and people that don't read to children, right?
Right, absolutely.
Librarian, like, I've read that book. The more I read it to even more classes, because it was just to have them experience that. It was a gift to us that read to children that they got to experience something different.
What's been really exciting about the book and its subsequent publication is that we've begun to hear from teachers who are using the book in the classroom and how... how strongly kids do respond to the book. And I think, you know, I hate to use the word gatekeeper, it's used to death, but I really believe that adults don't appreciate what a kid is capable of absorbing. And they worry so much about whether a book is appropriate. And I know from my own reading as a kid, I discovered the books that were appropriate for me. And I'm not talking about sexual content or violence or anything else, but just books that I responded to. And which sort of kind of segues into why I publish what I publish. And it's really being selfish because I publish books that I love. And I kind of hope that other people will love them too. Now, I will also say that internally, there's this 5, 6, 7 year old Neil Porter somewhere who I guess is part of that process. And so I'm publishing those books for him. But as I said before, I publish very selfishly. I tend not to pay much attention to trends or what's hot or what's not. The picture book production cycle is so long. Someone over the weekend, actually, I was at a conference and someone described it as equivalent to the gestation period of an elephant, which is something like 17 or 18 months. That if you were to try and jump on a trend, by the time the book came out, in most cases, the trend would be, you know, in the rearview mirror. So anyway, enough about that.
No, but so you're publishing what you love, and that tells me that in this time, you've been able to find, not only to find and articulate what you love, but then to be able to trust yourself enough and trust your intuition enough so as to not be swayed by the by those trends. But then how do you know what you love? Like when you're getting, I'm sure, a ton of submissions, does it come different ways, or is there sort of a certain weight to a manuscript that you know right away?
You know, it's that old thing, you know it when you see it, or you know it when you feel it. And I do, there's something that happens. There's a kind of click when I look at something that I just can't not publish if I'm afforded the opportunity to publish it. And that's really the litmus test for me. Is this a book I have to do? And it can happen with all kinds of books. You mentioned quiet books, and I guess I'm a quiet guy. Perhaps I'm particularly attracted to books that don't shout and scream. And I think the most obvious example of that is The Sick Day for Amos McGee, which when it came in, I remember thinking to myself, this is a very quiet book. And it was at the time when there were a lot of noisy books around, like Pinkalicious or Fancy Nancy. And, you know, because I worked in marketing, that also informs my publishing decisions. And I'm thinking, you know, is this book going to make its way in this cold, cold world we live in? But, you know, a lot of this is about playing hunches. And it's a book I felt so strongly about and connected with so personally that it was just, you know, well, I've got to do it. And as I said in other on other occasions, I remember saying when I had to present the book at a launch that there was something just I'm groping for the right word here. It was just very difficult to define, but you know, something in me told me that this book would connect with more people than would be apparent just at a casual glance at this very quiet book with an elderly man on the cover.
Well, I'm glad that whatever spoke to you spoke to you, because, yeah, it did. So you keep sort of, I feel like it's so funny to think to, I'm just going to call it out. I don't mean to make you uncomfortable. I'm going to call it out. I might as well go for it. So you were talking about avoiding trends and trying not to listen to it, but you must be aware, hopefully on some degree, that there are people that look to you because you're setting the trends. I mean, that's awesome. That's, how cool is that?
Like,
it happens. Come on. That's amazing. I love it.
But just to have a counterpoint to that quiet book, you take a book like Antoinette Portis's Best Prince in the Whole Universe, which is loud and raucous and rowdy and insanely crazy. Not only in terms of having created and invented alien language, but yes, the colors of the book look like, you know, an acid trip from my misspent youth.
I described it as it looks like a sorbet stand. The colors just kind of pop and they're right next to each other. It feels like it's transporting you to a different world. It's great. It all works together well.
Yeah. And that, in fact, is very different from her previous book, Wait, which I love equally much, but is a very tight and controlled and simple and very beautiful kind of meditative book. So, you know, it's exciting to me also when authors and artists try new things, and Antoinette can do a book like Wait and then turn around and shock the pants off of me by doing a book like Best Prince. And then her next book now is a return to an almost Zen-like quality. That it's really about living in the moment, and it's equally special in an entirely different way. So
I can't wait. That, I mean, this is also like the excitement that is living the life of Neil Porter, that you get to see. There are people that have been, they've continued their career with you. They've set out on their career with you. So you've gotten to be with them over that, the course of that career. I mean, we talk about Antoinette Portis. I know that you've done books with Miranda Paul, and I know that you've done books with, well, the Steads and Laura Seeger. And I just feel like to be able to be with them for that time is such a beautiful thing, that you get to see those things that they produce over that time. But I also know that you must be playing a role because of your relationship with them in their career to help grow that career, right? To help grow that voice?
I guess I do. A lot of it is unconscious. A lot of what we do is intuitive. You just kind of figure. I think the real challenge is to figure out how you can best serve the author / artist and the book. What are the right buttons to push? Not that it's a mechanical process, but everyone is different. And every one of my working relationships is different. You take someone like Laura Seeger, with whom I've worked since her very first book in, I think, 1999. And, you know, it's like playing. It's a very organic experience where we kind of sit around and pull out a journal and kick around ideas and then play What If, which is actually the title of one of her books. Yeah. And, you know, and then something happens. Sometimes it takes a very short time. Sometimes it takes years. But that's the way we work. In the case of Phil and Aaron, who are very different people, whom I love equally, they tend to be very, they have very definite ideas of what they want to do and what they'd like to do. And the material that I'm presented with is usually very tight and extremely well thought out. And it's just a different way of working. And, you know, I only want to work with people I like, frankly. That's my goal, because life is too short. And you know, you want to work with people who you have some kind of connection with. And I've been fortunate to have a lot of those relationships, and a lot of wonderful connections with people. And happily, they've resulted in books that I'm very proud of having a role in or a hand in.
I can see that. Yeah, again, they're beautiful. It was as I talked to Lisa on that interview, it became, the more I realized that you had a hand in, the more I just felt, I felt like I was knowing you, much like I've gotten to know authors by knowing their body of work. I felt like I got to know you by knowing your body of work too. Oh, and that, I should ask you then, just because this is something unclear totally to me, but what's your title now? Is your title publisher? Is your title maker of awesomeness or something? I don't know.
I don't know. Old
friends
geezer.
Of people, friends of curmudgeon, people I like.
Curmudgeon at large. Technically, my title is publisher of Neil Porter Books.
Yeah.
That's what it is, I guess. And go ahead.
When you were given the opportunity to have an imprint, which does not happen to people, I can't imagine. But even when it happened to you, your literal name is on these books. It's not as if you were like, okay, I'm going to have an imprint and it's going to be called Green Willow or something.
Right.
But your literal name is on it. I feel like the confidence, the way you stand behind your artists in your books, no wonder people want to spend their lives making books with you. You exude confidence and love for them. I mean, come on. Come on, Neil. This is amazing.
Oh, now I feel like, you know, the wizard behind the screen here. Because, you know, you may think that I exude confidence, but I'm as neurotic and insecure as anybody, and certainly a lot of the people I work with. And so that's kind of part of the equation, too. It's kind of scary to have your name on a book. And it serves a couple of different functions. I think it's been very useful because I think people who pay attention to such things kind of get a sort of collective sense of what I am and what I'm looking for, and hopefully, anyway. To most people who buy books in Barnes & Noble or even independent stores, they're completely oblivious to the publisher or the imprint on the spine. You buy books because you like them or love them or think they'd be right for your child or whatever. You buy a book because it's a Neil Porter book.
No.
In the library market, which is really a very important market, always has been in children's books and very important to me, maybe that's a little different. It's been my great fortune to spend a lot of years working with librarians. I attend ALA and have done for close to 40 years. And I guess maybe some of them know me or have a sense of what a Neil Porter book is, as you seem to.
These are things you start to notice. I should put it that way. You start to notice. You start to look and go, much like a parent would start to notice an illustrator's name over and over when you start to gravitate toward them. It was for me with Antoinette Portis. It was with Not a Box, and then it was I know this name. Oh, now I know her work. Now I can see it connect, and it sort of happened that way. But with a parent, though, the way that you're affecting is that you are choosing the books that go out, and ultimately they do go out, and they go out with confidence because the people that do buy the books to stock the stores and stock the libraries have come to know what they can expect from a book with your name on it. So I think there's so many working cogs here that end up all working to the benefit of our readers. And I guess really at the bottom of it, that's the most important thing.
Yeah. And yet, you know, there have been occasions when people have said, "Oh, are you really Neil Porter?" And I kind of look behind me and think they must be talking about somebody else or call me Mr. Porter. And I'm like, "Who? What?" But that's, you know, again, my neurosis coming to the fore.
The time that you've spent in publishing, do you have this experience? Then it sounds that, I mean, you've seen things change. Are you aware of your influence on that change, or have you sort of also been there just bearing witness to the change?
I'm certainly not aware of my influence to any significant degree, and you know, you kind of work in not in a vacuum, but you kind of do what you do.
You kind of do.
But I'm certainly aware of how the industry has evolved, since I began working in it. When I started in the, I guess, the very late 70s, beginning of the 80s, it was, unless you were Dr. Seuss or Judy Blume, you were publishing essentially for the library market. There was very little retail space given over to children's books, except for little Golden Books and a couple of the mass market series, and I Can Read books and stuff like that. So I'd say like 80 to 90% of the books that we published ended up in either school or public libraries, and that changed over time. It changed first with the emergence of children's only bookshops in the early to mid 80s, and in many cases these were started by librarians who had lost their jobs due to funding cutbacks, but who had the expertise and the background to be able to say, this is the perfect book for your child who is afraid of the dark, blah, 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 blah. Wow. And then this whole sort of retail market kind of expanded, and then we had the chains, and then it all became big business. And when I started, it was a kind of quiet backwater, and most general trade publishers had children's departments, but we were sort of like, you know, kind of, it was benign neglect. People really didn't know what we did or understand what we did. It didn't conform to the typical adult bestseller mentality. Our books had a much longer shelf life because they were library purchases. They didn't have a big flash and a huge sale in the first, you know, few months and then disappear. It was a much longer, I guess the current expression is long tail kind of thing. And that changed to the point where children's books began to mimic adult publishing in terms of ever larger advances and marketing budgets and touring and all that kind of stuff. So that's certainly what I've witnessed over my interminable career.
I love also that you've had the opportunity to see and to work alongside writers like Madeline L'Engle and Maurice Sendak and those people that ultimately have influenced the people you're working with today. Mm-hmm. I think that that's something that is incredibly powerful, and I guess it even calls to me then wondering in what ways you're working with other editors to help pass on your knowledge and continue this voice in children's publishing to move it forward.
You know, that's another thing that's changed very significantly in the years when I got into the business. There was very definitely a kind of mentorship built into the structure of the department. You began as an editorial assistant, or maybe you began as a reader, and you did time and a lot of grunt work, and you learn sort of by osmosis, and then gradually you might be given the chance to edit and import or work with an editor, and then you gradually built up a level of experience and you were promoted ever upwards. I don't know that that happens. It still happens to some degree, but things move so quickly these days that that whole kind of gestation period doesn't happen to the degree that it used to, and I worry that there's not an opportunity to pass on knowledge, accumulated knowledge from person to person to person. Also because so much of our contact with authors and artists these days, and with each other within the publishing company, is electronic. So there is no physical copy unless you print it out. And so it's very difficult unless you have an assistant kind of sitting on your shoulder, Jiminy Cricket style, to give them a sense of what the process is like. When I was at Farrar Straus in the late 70s, we circulated all of our editorial correspondence, and that's adult as well as children's. It's a big fat folder that fell on your inbox, and it contained Robert Giroux's editorial correspondence with Bernard Malamud or whomever. And you kind of, you know, you still had your job to do, but you would pick up this fat folder and start reading, and it was just, you know, and there was an education in that folder that I don't think exists anymore, certainly not in the way it did in those days.
No, much, much harder to pin it down if it does.
Yeah.
Goodness, it's funny, it's ironic, it's, I don't know what, that's the thing that moves fast in publishing. For how slow publishing is, the thing that moves fast is actually the communication, the thing that ought to be slow burning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so everything is, you know, very quick and over and out, and, you know, you're marching to a much quicker beat than was the case some time ago, even with that very long gestation period that I mentioned from acquisition to finished book.
To finished book, yeah. So I read, and I assume it's close to still being this, that you're publishing something like 18 books a year, primarily picture books,
mm-hmm.
But about somewhere around 18.
18 to 20, 24. I've just been, you know, stop me before I kill again.
Well, I was going to say, I can imagine if you're growing the number of people you're working with and all of them are still writing and you still are seeing new stuff, that maintaining a lower number kind of gets challenging.
Yeah, it is challenging. And also because, you know, Neil Porter Books consists of myself and Jennifer Brown, who has designed just about all of my books. For the last 24 or 5 years, she works on a freelance basis from her home in New Jersey. I work with an associate editor who started as my assistant named Emily Feinberg, who's terrific. But she's begun to acquire and edit her own books. So, you know, there's not a lot of fat.
Three people. Goodness.
Yeah. But I know the books that Emily does and are not published as Neil Porter Books. They're published as Roaring Brook because, I don't know, I just felt that if my name was on the book, I should be the guy.
Yeah.
So that's just a personal decision that I made.
All right. So as the guy, what new stuff do you have coming out soon that we should be aware of? Samson in the Snow is beautiful. For those that haven't seen it, they had some advanced copies at conferences that I've been to recently, and it's just wonderful.
Thank you. Yeah, it's a gorgeous book, and there's more coming from Phil. Including a book about animals that is a little bit like Ideas Are All Around, which I'm very excited to see what he does with. It's a very, you know, I like to do books that tend to fall into a handful of categories. I like to do books that take a familiar subject and find a way to make them fresh. And this isn't forthcoming. It actually came out in June, but Adam Rex and Christian Robinson's School's First Day of School.
Oh, that was yours. I love it. Yes.
Yeah. I mean, how many First Day of School books are there? If you Google them on Amazon, they're 50, 100, I don't know what. And yet, what genius to tell that same story, not from the child's point of view, but from the school's point of view. It's the school's first day. He's just been built, and he's really nervous. And he doesn't know whether he's going to like the kids. And he's freaking out.
And he only has one fire drill.
Yeah, that's right. And he's embarrassed about it. And, you know, when they put a push pin into his bulletin board, he feels it.
Yeah.
So I love that book, and I think what Adam did with a very simple idea is brilliant, because it's not easy to do a completely charming, involving book about an inanimate thing, a school.
Building. Yeah, right.
And of course, Christian completed the package with these wonderful illustrations that, you know, it wasn't a big, goofy, small school with a big, you know, howdy-doody smile on it. It was very subtly, you could see a line in the doorstep that could have been a smile, or the eyes that were positioned in a certain way on the doors that looked sad at a sad moment in the book. And, you know, it's just a book that makes me happy every time I look at it. So that's a book that, you know, takes something old and makes it fresh. And Phil's book, Ideas, which we talked about, I think is unconventional in every respect. It's an unconventional idea told unconventionally, because he's used so many different kinds of art styles in the book, from transfer and collage and printmaking and Polaroid pictures to tell that story. And then on the other end of the spectrum is a very traditionally told and illustrated book by Richard Jackson, who was a great mentor of mine. He's a great editor of countless marvelous award-winning books, and illustrated by Jerry Pinkney, called In Plain Sight, which is essentially the story of a grandfather who's quite unwell. He's in a wheelchair, and his incredibly touching relationship with his granddaughter, who comes to visit him each day. And they play a game, a kind of find and seek game. He hides something and she finds it. And it's very cleverly done, because the things he hides are all, you know, things from a very well-lived life. And if you look around the room, because it mostly takes place in one room, you see all of these things, all of which have significance for the grandfather and ultimately for the little girl, whose name is Sophie, and for us. So that's a book I'm really happy about. That comes out this fall. Candy Fleming and Eric Roman's Squid.
I know that one. I got a copy of that. I'm looking forward to talking to them soon.
Yeah, I mean, again, you find a subject that kids are fascinated by, giant squids. You can say it either way. You could do a straightforward nonfiction book about giant squid. And what's interesting about it is there's so little known about these creatures, because it was only very recently that we were able to see them in their natural habitat. But Candy just created this incredibly powerful, poetic text.
Yes.
And then Eric did these marvelous paintings, and the whole thing feels like a movie to me. And just, you know, I remain influenced by theater, my background in the theater, and also by movies, which I love. One of the things that I like a lot about Giant Squid is that the book just starts on page one with the text talking about the squid, and then it kind of goes on and it goes on, and you learn more and more about the squid. And the title spread for the book is like on page 6 and 7, and that feels very movie-like and cinematic. It sort of draws you into this weird world of deep underwater, and then gradually the title kind of surfaces, and then you sort of go on to the remainder of the book.
I like that. I like the way in that book that it feels like you, the reader, are positioned with a camera down in the deepest parts of the ocean, and the squid is sort of just swimming by, and we just catch, there's the eye, and there's part of the body. I like that it's experienced that way, just in pieces at
first. Yeah, you really don't see the squid as an entire entity until this dramatic gatefold at the end of the book. So you're only seeing bits and pieces that are discussed. Mm-hmm. And then you then you see the whole thing, which I think is another kind of cinematic moment. Speaking of gatefolds, a book that I'm very excited about that comes out next winter is Jason Chin's book about the Grand Canyon.
Jason, I had no idea.
Yeah. It's sort of like, it's big in every way. It's big format. It's 56 pages, I think. It's incredibly detailed and lush and beautiful, and you follow a girl and her caregiver or dad, it's not clear what, on a trip down to the floor of the Grand Canyon. And Jason is so great. He's such a wonderful researcher as well as a wonderful painter. And he's really pulled out the stops this time, because there are die cuts scattered throughout the book. So you're seeing in real time the girl discovering a fossil. And when you turn the page, you're transported back several million years ago through this hole, and you see the fossil when it was a live creature. Wow. And that happens, I think, four or five times throughout the book, maybe six. And then, of course, at the end, there's another spectacular double gatefold of the Grand Canyon in all its glory. And then a lot of bibliographic information and essays and kind of what we call back matter to sort of complete the package. It's sort of his I don't know, cinerama masterpiece, I think. I love the book a lot, as you can tell.
I love the idea, even in a double gatefold, that as a reader, you sort of then are surrounded by that image, be it of the Grand Canyon or whatever is depicted there. You're in it. Your head is down there in it.
Yeah, completely and utterly. And the word back matter reminds me of a funny story. I was working on a book that you may know called The Iridescence of Birds with Patricia McLaughlin.
The Matisse story, right?
Matisse book, yeah.
Oh, man, that was a gorgeous book.
And that was, I mean, that's another remarkable achievement, because I've done a lot of nonfiction without realizing it's nonfiction, just because I like the stories. And I love art and done a lot of books about art and love artists. But Patty told that story, the entire text is two sentences long. And it's not even two, it's two questions. And everything was there. And I remember I said, "No, Patty, you got to do some back matter. I want an essay talking about Matisse and your response to Matisse." And I also asked the artist, Hadley Hooper, to do the same. And Patty said, back matter. It always reminds me of something digestive. Yeah, that is the distinguished author Sarah Plain and Tall in a nutshell. She's the funniest, sharpest people. It's been my pleasure to work with.
Oh, goodness.
There's a story. I had to get a good, juicy anecdote, and that's one of my favorites.
Well, my word, you are full of stories. I would love if we could do this again sometime. Would you be willing to do this again sometime?
Absolutely. This has been a blast.
Thank you, Neil. I look forward to it. Before I let you go, I'm going to leave you with a question for children, for those readers that you're affecting. But I do want to say one more time, thank you so much for your generosity in the love you have for these books and the time you spent here to share about all that you've garnered and all that you've influenced in children's publishing. I'm truly grateful that you exist in publishing and that also our paths crossed.
If you could see me, I'd be blushing and turning purple, but thank you very much. Those are very kind things to say.
Just like one of Antoinette Portis's aliens.
Perfect. That's right. Yeah, absolutely.
All right, Neil, here we go. I'm going to see a library full of children tomorrow morning. What message would you like for me to bring to them from you?
Read everything. Don't read what adults tell you you should read. Well, you can read that if you want to, but also just lose yourself in a book. Lose yourself in a book that you might not even think you'd like. But let you know, take a risk, take a chance, and you might just fall in love.
This podcast is recorded and produced by me, Matthew Winner, in my library studio in Ellicott City, Maryland. You can subscribe to the podcast and access the archive of over 250 episodes at All the Wonders, a home for readers to discover new books and to experience the stories they love in wondrous ways. Go beyond the book at allthewonders.com and check out other podcasts from All the Wonders, including the Picture Booking Podcast with Nick Patton, a semi-weekly podcast about picture books and the people who make them. Our theme music is by Emily Arrow. All views and opinions expressed on the show are those of the individuals, myself included, and do not reflect ideas or viewpoints of the publishers of the books referenced. Listeners, if the episode connected with you, I'd love to hear it. Leave a comment on allthewonders.com or rate this podcast on iTunes or Stitcher through stars or reviews. Sharing the podcast with friends through Facebook and Twitter, word of mouth, or any other means helps reach more listeners, which leads to more content and more amazing guests. And that's a very good thing indeed. Coming up on the podcast, Abby Hanlon talks about her Dory Phantasmagory series, and I marvel at her skill in capturing the voice of a young, passionate child. See you then, and thanks for listening. We know you value what you put in front of your kids, especially when it comes to screens and podcasts. That's why we're excited to share a new podcast from our friends at Sleepiest, creating bedtime stories to help your kids fall asleep fast.
Hello, Abby here. If you've got children and find bedtime's a struggle, I'd like to tell you about Coco Sleep, a children's story podcast designed to make bedtime a dream. Coco Sleep turns a chaotic bedtime into cozy bonding time. The stories are delivered in a pace that gently slows. Rumour has it that no one's ever heard an ending. So search Coco Sleep on your favourite podcast app and let's make bedtime a dream. That's K-O-K-O Sleep, and I'll see you there.